It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to the Manchester United Weekly Podcast season review of 2021-22. In this two-parter, we'll first be looking back at the campaign just gone, our favourite moments, and yes, there were some goals and players. We'll consider, with the benefit of hindsight, where it went wrong for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and then where it went wrong for his interim successor, Ralf Rangnick, as well. We'll compare the 21-22 defence to that of the season before, and the same for the attack. We'll consider how the team's style changed under Ole and then Ralf, and we'll talk about a flurry of departures, how our loanees fared away from United, and what the year was like for our academy as FA Youth Cup winners. In part two, released a day or two after this one, we'll be looking ahead to the era of Erik ten Hag. We'll consider what needs to be done with regards to recruitment, character, squad harmony, club structure, ownership, captaincy, goalkeeper, midfield, defence, attack, and transfers, transfers, and transfers again. And we'll answer some questions from the patrons who have supported the show all throughout the season, for which we are very grateful. I'm Harry Robinson with Jack Tate alongside me as always, and we'll get stuck in quickly, starting off on a positive before we let the gloom take over. Your favourite moment of the season, Jack, because for however terrible we think this year has been, and it has been, there have been a surprising number of brilliant, ecstatic moments, actually.
There have, weirdly so. And I think about this season, I just straight away go to all of the bad parts. But yeah, there have been some real highs and some huge lows, more so than most seasons, I think. I mean, there are a few obvious ones. Obviously, the start of the season, the first two home games, Leeds and then Newcastle, yeah, really stand out. Leeds, I mean, I'll let you talk more about Leeds because I think you were there, and it just sounds like an amazing day. But yeah, Newcastle, especially with Ronaldo sort of homecoming, scoring two goals, it felt like, you know, we're here. I think at that point we'd won three and drawn one of our first four games as well. So, you know, everything seemed to be moving in the right direction. One that I'd actually forgotten about and came to mind as I was trying to think of ones for this was also West Ham away early on in the season. Lingard coming on, scoring against his former team, and then De Gea's second penalty save. Wasn't that his first penalty save in like 10 years or something?
It was
5 or 6 years.
Maybe not in years, but it was first in, I think I remember it being first in 40 penalty saves. In 40 penalty attempts, and the fact it was against Mr. West Ham Football Club, Mark Noble, who came onto the pitch, took the captain's armband and the penalty in his kind of retirement parade of a season. And then
that was like peak Premier League.
It was brilliantly, in the most bitter way imaginable. And I don't know why I'm bitter towards Mark Noble. I don't dislike him that much. But it was just fantastic irony, especially against the goalkeeper who had just months before not only missed a penalty in the Europa League final, but failed to save 11 of them in a row. So yeah, that was funny. And yeah, that's the thing. You look back at our fixtures, and actually there were some amazing ones, even West Ham at home as well in January. Ole had gone by that point, but the last minute winner from Marcus Rashford. And that was, I think, the key to a lot of these, and not West Ham away, but the key to a lot of them has been the kind of post COVID atmospheres at Old Trafford, which have been
100%
honestly really amazing at times. And West Ham was one of them, just absolutely bouncing coming out of the ground then. But there's been others. Arsenal, the 3-2 win at home and just before Ranić came in. Atalanta, the 3-2 win, the Ronaldo-led win in the Champions League on the Ole. And that was at a time where you thought, this is it. This isn't going right for Solskjaer. Maybe this is the one that turns it around. There was just an amazing connection between team, manager and fans at that point.
Yeah.
Villarreal at home in the Champions League as well.
That, I think that's a really underrated one.
Yeah. It's a crazy amount of great moments. And yeah, of course, Leeds on the first day was something really special and yeah, really memorable. And obviously, even taking away the idea of the fact how much hope we had, and we thought, oh wow, maybe this team's better than we thought, and Varane coming out, even taking away all of that, just being back in a ground with 75,000 people and kind of seeing people you hadn't seen for 18, 24 months was just fantastic by itself. But also Leeds away and Atleti away was not an amazing result, but it was a great goal. And so there's been all sorts of amazing moments. Which is, I mean, maybe it should change how we kind of reflect on the season a little bit. We will obviously go into the, in some detail, we'll go into the bad bits. But as a fan, we will remember those good moments probably more than we remember the bad ones. We'll remember losing to City and Liverpool, obviously, but we'll probably remember the good moments more than like we remember drawing to Everton or drawing to Villa or that kind of thing.
I think this also is just reinforcing the idea that we were a pretty average team for a lot of the season, because pretty much all of these moments are us having to score late last minute winners against teams that we should be beating every day of the week as well. You know, these aren't like last minute winners against Man City or Arsenal, or well, one of them was Arsenal, not a last minute, but a win against Arsenal. But it's not like these are huge teams we're beating. It's like last minute goals to beat West Ham or dominate Newcastle or Leeds I think we had this season of like very, very high highs and then very low lows, because we were quite an average team. So many of our games were decided by like the odd moment, the odd goal here or there. We didn't really have many comfortable like 2 or 3 nil victories.
Yeah. And I reflect on this season as I think, and I imagine most people will agree with this, as the worst I've seen in my lifetime. For all sorts of reasons, whether it's results on the pitch or the attitude on the pitch, but also events off the pitch, none more prominent and notable and significant than Mason Greenwood's arrest in January, which I think is underrated in the way it clouded over the rest of the season, and in a way that it clouded over, obviously, Mason Greenwood himself, who was at the time playing very well and was kind of United's star boy, but also it took the shine off the whole squad in a way. Because it kind of took away that kind of bubble around the players of, I don't know how to phrase it perfectly, but I think it overshadowed the rest of the season, even at times when we didn't notice it. So it has been the worst season in my lifetime for a whole plethora of reasons.
On the pitch only, this isn't a particularly important question for now, but on the pitch purely, do you think this was worse than the Moyes season?
On the pitch purely, no, because well, we did have some great moments in the Moyes season as well. Although one of them was leading Bayern Munich for 22 seconds rather than any more than that. But there were, I don't know. It's hard to remember without.
Maybe the worst moment of that season is Welbeck trying to chip Moyes. Old Trafford.
I think there was such a, I don't know. It's very hard to tell. And this is going maybe too in depth on it, but the way that I think we analysed football in the Moyes season was very different to the way that football is analysed and picked over, and every mistake is torn apart now.
That's true.
So I think it's really difficult, and we obviously could compare them if we went back and watched games, but also the Premier League is just at a completely different tactical level to what it was in the 2013-14 season. So this season's been really bad, but on the pitch, the football probably has been better. I can't in my head compare them like off the top of my head. So I don't know, but you're right. A lot of what's wrong this season, not in terms of Mason Greenwood or anything like that, but a lot of what's been wrong this season has been off the pitch and the realization of just how bad things are.
Right.
Which we didn't know in 2013.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's part of what makes this season just so bad, because it's like, at this point, you're almost sort of at the end of your tether with Man United. You know, it's almost like if you've got a badly behaved child, you know, and you've tried every single parenting idea in the book to try and help them get them on the straight and narrow, and you're just kind of like, what am I supposed to do with you now? And that's kind of feel like where we're sort of at with Man United. We've tried everything. Where, yeah, I guess there was sort of blissful ignorance at the time during the Moyes season that, oh, it's just a season, we'll get a better manager and then everything will go back to how it was. On the pitch, purely, I would probably say this has been slightly better than the Moyes season, just because I think the overall, sort of in the aggregate, I think it's been about as bad as each other. But as we've been saying here, I think we've had better good moments this season. And I think that probably just sways it in favour of this year, purely on the pitch.
Well, we finished one place higher this year, but we got to a Champions League quarterfinal under Moyes. And I mean, for an example, the comeback against Olympiacos in the second leg, 3-0, Van Persie scoring at Old Trafford.
That was amazing, yeah.
That was a great moment. And I'm sure there are others. There are some that I'm thinking of, but I'm sure there are more that we're forgetting. So, yeah, it's an interesting one, but also a horrendous activity to have to participate in if you wanted to spend hours looking at comparing Moyes to the Ole Ranić season.
If anyone wants to come on and do a special over the summer, you can be a guest and talk about which one of these seasons was worse than the other, then let us know.
Yeah, you can not only be a guest, you can host the whole thing, because I don't want to be involved in that. On the subject of horrible things to do, worst moment of the season for me was, yes, Liverpool home and away were both terrible, but I think the City game at home, particularly because of the emotions around it, when City were playing around in the corner and no one was able to win the ball back, and the only way we could stop them doing it was just by kicking them, and even that we didn't do very well. And it was the fact that we'd seen Liverpool do the same thing just a couple of weeks before, and also the fact that at that point it was just blatantly obvious that things couldn't continue under the manager that at least I loved and a club legend. And it was the realization that, yeah, this is over. But not only the realization this is over, but in front of your rivals who were just toying with you in a training session. So for me, City at home, the worst, but having been at Anfield as well for the 4-0, that was also pretty bad. But given Liverpool didn't end up winning the league, less bad than it could have been.
Yeah, all four of those games against City and Liverpool, home and away, were... they were astronomically bad. I think the worst sort of specific moment for me out of those four games only would be actually the first goal that we conceded at Anfield, because it was after it was literally what, like 5 minutes
three
or something,
or four,
and it was a shambolic goal, one ball over the top, and we had Phil Jones against like three Liverpool attackers all bearing down on goal, and it was like, Not that you could excuse what happened the first time around at home. You couldn't at all. But it was sort of like you went into the second one, and at least personally, I think a lot of fans were thinking, right, there's no way we can be as bad as we were the first time. You know, the first time we were in, it was sort of the beginning of that horrible run. It sort of felt like everything was coming to an end. We weren't playing great under Ranić in the lead up to the Anfield game, but at least it felt like we maybe had a manager who tactically could maybe do a little bit more to help us in the game.
And instead, he got it tactically completely wrong instead.
Maybe even worse than we did the first time. Other than those four games, there was three that I could think of. So one was Atleti at home, just going out in that Champions. Not only because we lost, but because of that. I can remember watching that second half, and I feel like I could have sat there at half time and written out almost exactly how that second half was going to play out. It was just so predictable in how bad it was going to go.
Because the whole rest of, like, all of our hopes for the season was dependent on that second half, and it didn't go right, and so you left the ground.
And we'd actually played really well to start the game as well.
Yeah,
You know, hadn't really got our reward for it, and it just, that second half was so, so predictable. And then the other two that I had was from very, very early on in the season. Who remembers the last minute winning goal that we conceded to Young Boys back in September, that would have been, I think. Who was it that gave, was it Lingard who gave the ball?
It was Lingard, came on for his, everyone, he'd been asking for a chance and he came off the bench for that. And
yeah,
he'd obviously, and then three or four days after that, then he scored against West Ham.
Yeah.
So
he made a bit of a redemption arc for him.
Yeah, definitely.
And then the other one, this wasn't so bad in terms of the result. It was just a real sucker punch that I sort of took quite hard personally. Was the 2-2 draw against Villa.
Yeah.
In, was it January or February? Something like that.
January.
We were actually playing quite well under Ranić at that point, and we played really well against Villa, scored two good goals, and then Coutinho, of all people, came on, scored twice in a couple of minutes. And that felt like such a gut punch at the time, because that Villa game should have been a real sort of stepping stone for us. I felt like, we had started to play better. It felt like a corner was sort of being turned, and that it killed all of our momentum. So that for me was I remember feeling really, really down when that second goal went in.
Yeah, we might reference that when we go on to where did it go wrong for Ralph. Before we do, and we'll talk about Ole first as well, but very quickly, best goal for me, the one that won the club's end of season vote, was Ronaldo's against Tottenham in the hat trick where he just thumped it. His other against Spurs away from home, the over the shoulder volley, that was also lovely. The others I can instantly think of, Telles against Villarreal was nominated for Champions League goal of the season, obviously didn't win it, but was put up there. Bruno's thumper, the third goal against Leeds, the hat-trick goal, and the other one that I'd forgotten about but is actually a brilliant goal and I think my favourite of the year, despite I don't even think I really saw it at the time, from the away end in Bergamo, but Ronaldo and Fernandes combining, the back heel from Fernandes, Ronaldo's finish against Atalanta in the 2-2 away draw.
Yeah, that was a great goal. It really sort of flew under the radar because I think it got like subsumed, didn't it? Because the ending of that game was crazy, as most of our Champions League group games were. But yeah, that was a great goal. I think of the only other one that I had on my list was Fred in Ranić's first game. Weak foot, sort of over the keeper into the far corner. Think of the ones we mentioned. My favourite would probably be Telles' goal. I'm a sucker for a volley, especially direct from a corner. So I love that goal. So also the way the camera angle was for it. Love goals where you just get like directly behind it and it just looks so perfect.
Yeah, it was great. And I'm going to name drop here, but I spoke to Telles about that goal. And given how excited, this was about 2 months after as well, and given how excited he was about it still, maybe that pushes it up to my favourite, because he was just, I was like, how was it to do that in front of the Stretford end? And he was just beaming like, yeah, it was brilliant. And I thought, yeah, that's how it should be. That's how excited you should be about scoring a goal like that in front of the Stretford end.
Yeah.
Best player. There's three candidates. I think everyone knows who they are: Fred, De Gea and Ronaldo. For me, Fred, great second half of the season, but not good enough before Christmas. De Gea was a great shot stopper, but I don't think I can vote for him, because I particularly, Anfield away was the one game where I really noticed it, that he was not the reason we lost that game, obviously, and got thumped, but it was the one game I really noticed it. His distribution was just terrible. And Ronaldo had some negative spells as well, just after Christmas especially. But the way that Ronaldo, A, was great for the first 2 months, and then the way that after, from the Spurs game onwards, was just kind of unstoppable when he played sometimes. And his performance, even in defeat away at Arsenal, was really good in terms of just overall. His end to the season, for me, means that I would give my vote to him for best player of the season.
Yeah, I sort of didn't want to give it to Ronaldo as I was sort of preparing for the podcast, but the more I thought about it, I don't really see how I could give it to anyone else. Fred, I agree with you. I don't think Fred was consistent enough. Of the three of them, I think De Gea probably was the most consistent, actually. I don't think he really had a particularly bad spell, but I just think that De Gea's general game, his limitation with the ball at his feet, I'm not saying it was like a massive, massive problem for a lot of the season, because we had a lot of other really bad issues in our team and his shot stopping was needed. But I don't think I can give it to him when I think that he did limit us quite a lot. And, Ronaldo had bad spells, but ultimately still ended up with, what was it, like 26, 27 goals in all competitions, maybe even more. I don't really see how you can give it to anyone else when he really did drag us through so many bad performances.
I'll give De Gea extra respect for the kind of additional leadership role he took on this season. Not that it helped, but being the one that would come out and front up after games and being very, very often painfully honest in interviews. So I'll give him some extra respect for that. but Ronaldo from both of us. Right.
Yeah.
We've spent too long on that. Let's move on. Where did it go wrong for Solskjaer? It's a big question. One we've had a bit of hindsight for. We're just going to run through it. Not too in depth because we did that at the time. But looking back, I mean, first of all, it's sad, isn't it? Looking back, and I saw a clip, inadvertently just saw a clip of his farewell interview the other day and was like, oh, that still makes me sad, particularly thinking back to Gdansk and thinking what could have been. And that's, I mean, to be fair, that's where it started to go wrong and where it probably should have ended was losing to Villarreal in Gdansk. And he and we will always regret the fact we didn't win and the club will as well. And it was strange, his departure, because fans and players were upset to see him go, even if the massive vast majority knew that he had to at that point. But I do look back and think it said a lot that A, our decision was made so poorly. It wasn't made in that November international break, and that our decision was based and dependent on whether or not we lost to Watford away from home. And is it naive to think it shouldn't be like that? Maybe. But I think it says a lot about what those making decisions knew, or more what they didn't know and they should have known during the summer, that they could have changed it in the summer and chose not to. And then also still got the decision wrong. And when they sacked him, didn't have a replacement lined up.
Yeah, I was looking back through our results as we were sort of preparing for this, just to sort of re-familiarise myself with what the sequence of events was that led up to Solskjaer being sacked. And the more you look at it, yeah, the more it seems ludicrous that Solskjaer was even allowed to get to the Watford game, to be honest. I mean, we'd obviously been having some bad form. We'd lost really badly to Liverpool. We then lost quite badly to Leicester as well. And then came the Man City game. And, you know, it should have been after the Man City game that he went. We then had an international break. We didn't play a game between Man City and Watford. Man City was on November the 6th and Watford was November the 20th. So, you know, we had 2 weeks there to make an appointment. I think yeah. It was an international break, you know, and maybe we wouldn't have ended up with Ranić, maybe we wouldn't have ended up with yeah. Interim, who knows? But yeah, it smacked of, yeah, just no planning. And I think that's something that's run through a lot of the Solskjaer era and that isn't really in his control. I think in terms of where it went wrong for him, in hindsight, and I don't think we could have known this at the time, but in hindsight, with everything that's happened since he left, I think what we've seen is that the foundation on which his relative success in his first two seasons was built, I think was a lot more shaky than it seemed. You know, I think the dressing room, which publicly, I think under Solskjaer looked pretty harmonious, mainly because of him and how, you know, well he spoke about the players and how happy they all seemed to be playing for him, was not as harmonious and wasn't in good spirits as it seemed. I think we always knew that tactically he probably wasn't as good as, you know, the likes of Pep or Klopp or anyone on any of those top managers. And we knew that, I think, all along. I think what really sort of was the beginning of the end, though, was that when things did start to go wrong quite spectacularly last autumn, is that lack of maybe tactical ability at the top level then started to, I think, undermine his presence in the dressing room. And I think what you need in a time when maybe a manager isn't running on a lot of confidence is you need a really strong, close-knit squad with a lot of leaders to sort of pull the squad through almost in spite of the manager. And the dressing room was far more fractured than we ever realised. And I think it just couldn't recover from that. So rather than the team putting themselves up, it got so much worse. And the culmination of that was the second half in that 2-0 defeat to Man City when, I mean, the players effectively gave up, didn't they?
Yeah, his man management is the thing we often picked out as one of his really good abilities. And I think at the time, I certainly thought his man management was up there with the best in the league, not as a full-on manager, but in terms of his man management. And the reason for that was the improvement in Luke Shaw, the improvement in Rashford, the management of and how Mason Greenwood was brought through and lots of things like that. And yet, actually, looking back, in that autumn, we realised anyway, but especially now, we realised that it wasn't there. And he made some bad decisions that created distrust from players and in the squad by, for example, keeping Chris Smalling for the summer and then suddenly on the deadline day saying, no, you need to find a new club, and Smalling went to Roma, by keeping Lingard saying he was going to get the game time and then not giving it to him, Ahmad's lack of playing time, giving a new contract to Bailly and saying he'd play when he didn't. And I mean, even in the transfer of Van der Beek, kind of accepting that transfer when he clearly wasn't the player that he wanted, Van der Beek. And there were other players who were complaining, like Dallo, who couldn't get in ahead of Wan-Bissaka. He had his favourites. And I think we said at the time there was fault all round from Solskjaer for that and his lack of tactical ability, in especially in his third season, but also at points in his second. And then in terms of the board, just complete wrong decisions again and again. I think we recorded an episode after the Europa League final where we said we were really torn over what the right decision was to do, and it's a hard one. But if you were working in the club, you should know all of those kind of underlying factors and what's going wrong. That's kind of your job to know if you're the decision maker. And they should have made the decision to move on from Solskjaer after Gdansk, after he'd kind of improved the club. And yeah, I just think Woodward was obsessed with trying to create another Alex Ferguson. And I think that tells you everything you need to know about, A, his lack of knowledge in how to do that, but also kind of his self-importance and egotism in wanting to be the man who created the next Ferguson. And so we had no plan. And in the end, we hung Ole out to dry. As you say, he should have gone well before the Watford game. And then, and then there's the players, isn't there? Not taking things on board, not dissenting against Solskjaer, but also not listening enough, not respecting him and his coaching staff, and their own poor form, and the divides in the squad, the lack of leadership, divides on age, language and culture, not attending team meals, and having massive divisions in the squad that a squad with good leadership would iron out over summers and over months and over a season. And they didn't do that. And we saw that very, very clearly under Rangnick at the end.
Yeah, exactly. I think this you learn the most about a dressing room when things are going badly, right? As you do with most groups of people.
Yeah.
And when things started to go wrong on Solskjaer, the response wasn't what we wanted it to be, and it wasn't the response we wanted it to be pretty much the entire time that Rangnick was there as well. So I think, I don't know if it was maybe the higher expectations that we had coming into this season that maybe made the dressing room feel a little bit more entitled, maybe made some of the egos more of a problem than they had been in the preceding years. But whatever it was, I think we definitely saw that this was, I don't necessarily want to throw around the word toxic, but I think it probably was quite a toxic atmosphere and quite a toxic dressing room to be part of. Everything that we've heard, especially recently, about how things transpired in the dressing room at Old Trafford, definitely don't, they're definitely not what you want to be hearing. But like you said, that should be something that the club are aware of. And in hindsight as well, now that Rangnick has confirmed that he won't be taking up his consultancy. Well, he hasn't confirmed. The club have confirmed that he won't be taking up his consultancy role. It also now feels like pretty much the entire time he was here calling everyone out publicly probably didn't help that atmosphere.
No.
Because it's sort of worth doing that if he was then going to be part of rebuilding it, so he can see how players respond to that kind of pressure of being put out there publicly. But as it was, we just spent 6 months tearing down every player in our dressing room for the guy that was doing it to have no part in rebuilding that squad.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. That appointment kind of just threw away our season, didn't it? And at the time, it seemed good, but we sacrificed the season.
Oh, yeah.
It was the wrong decision.
Yeah.
And I think there is a scenario where Rangnick could have had some limited success as interim manager at United, but it required a couple of things, I think. First of all, a bit of continuation in the coaching staff rather than Carrick and McKenna both leaving, or getting Rangnick the coaches that he wanted in, because Chris Armas and Sasha Lenz were not his first choice coaches, and giving him more support in that, because it sounds like he was scrambling around to find the coaches he wanted rather than getting any kind of sustained support in that. And then also giving him some more backing inside, saying to the players, being visible in terms of that leadership above Rangnick, in terms of Murta and Fletcher and Richard Arnold and even Joel Glazer, if you want, publicly, but more importantly, privately backing Rangnick and going into the dressing room. Someone should be there, whether it's Fletcher, but Fletcher's role made harder by the fact that he was also coaching and also on the bench. So maybe it has to be Murta going in there and saying, no, this is our man, we're backing him. You need to respect him and you need to play for him and you need to do that. And there's no sign that was there at United. And so Rangnick was, as in the same way that Solskjaer was hung out to dry at the end, Rangnick was hung out to dry for a season. That being said, some of his decisions were also rubbish, and his level of management just was not there.
No, not at all. And that should not go unnoticed at all, because regardless of, you know, where sort of how the club have mishandled the situation, a person with that kind of reputation should be able to put a better team out on the pitch than what he did during the 6 months in charge. And that is completely fair to say. I think the whole scenario with Ranić just, it makes no sense. And it's not the first time we've had to say that about decisions made by United. I think the problem was, right, that when you bring someone in as an interim manager, normally you bring them in to be kind of a safe pair of hands, someone who's not going to rock the boat, will just steady things up, get some stability back to the club, you know, maybe go on a run in one of the cup competitions, but mainly just to shore things up, get things back to some stable level, so that when a new manager comes in the next season, they've got a much better base to build from. And so you've seen at Chelsea, for example, Goose Hiddink doing that a couple of times before. You know, someone who's very experienced, reliable, isn't going to do too much to you know, like I said, not going to rock the boat. The problem, though, is when you bring someone in as an interim manager with this consultancy role on the end, it's like, well, Ranić now has some power over the direction of the club. Again, I know that consultancy role was never fully sort of formalised in what it was going to be, but I think it was a pretty good bet that Ranić was going to have some say in where our future direction would be. So, of course, he's then going to start saying things and trying to sort of make pointed comments that point a little bit towards what the future might look like, because he thinks he's going to be part of that. So in sort of the power dynamics between Ranić and the players, Ranić is sort of above them there, because his role is much more secure than any of the players in United's future. But then now that we've taken that consultancy role away, we've just had an interim manager for 6 months who actually, as it turned out, was far below the players in terms of the pecking order of their importance to United going forward. But we've let that less important person come out publicly and basically say that 60% of our squad need basically binning off, and that we need to make 10 new signings to get anywhere. And yet he's nowhere to be seen. So he's just thrown away a season, had half our dressing room called out in the press by someone who now has absolutely no role in the club. And I don't actually blame Ranić for that necessarily. I blame Ranić for how badly we performed on the pitch, because no matter what, that was unacceptable. But the club framed his role completely differently to how it has ended up turning out. And I think it all goes back to when he was hired, that consultancy role was never properly framed. It was never properly defined what he was actually going to be doing. You know, was he going to be a sporting director? Was he basically just going to be asked here and there on a couple of transfers?
Yeah, and fans and Ranić and the media were hoodwinked by the club in that consultancy role. Because at the time it seemed like the concept of having an interim manager and then going into consultancy, as I think I said at the time repeatedly, seemed like a really good one. But
makes a lot of sense.
In the way that it was done, it was terrible. And it's hard not to think that the treatment of Ranić and the way that this was all done is typical of how United approach change. Because when we're backed into a corner, the Glazers offer kind of a gesture of openness. And this is the same with the European Super League. They offer a gesture of openness and reform or change, but it's only ever lip service and it's only ever forced. And if they can then get out of doing it in the future, then they will. And so, for example, the fan share scheme that was floated and demanded after the European Super League has just been kind of pushed around. And there is some progress going on with it, but it should have happened within months after it was demanded, and it's not. On the other hand, and there is certainly different perspectives to this, on the other hand, we got Ranić in so we didn't rush an incorrect appointment and so that we could get Erik ten Hag. And when we did get Erik ten Hag, then he himself wasn't convinced by Ranić and so he's gone. That's the other perspective. I think it's obviously the much kinder perspective to the club's decision makers. The truth, I think, is as always, is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, it definitely will be somewhere in the middle. But I really liked how you framed that of, you know, we were sort of hoodwinked by the club, because, I mean, even take the two of us on this podcast, I think, I know I was very, not hesitant to criticise Ranić, but maybe hesitant to call his time at United a failure, because I always maintained and always said for 5 months that I will judge Ranić based on what he does in his consultancy role and how he rebuilds this squad, because that was always going to be the more important part of his time at United. And so effectively, I think actually Ranić escaped a lot of criticism for how we've played on the pitch, because we all thought,
definitely,
well, you know what, to some degree, not that this season doesn't matter, but I'll judge Ranić in 2 years when I see what he's done with this squad and helping us rebuild with a new manager. When actually he was just an interim manager for 6 months, and
yeah,
he's one of the worst managers we've ever seen at United in terms of purely what we saw on the pitch, without a shadow of a doubt. So we've all been completely hoodwinked, because it really has, I think, stopped a lot of scrutiny and stopped a lot of criticism coming his way. Because, like I said, we thought he was going to be around for a much longer time to help sort of create this new vision, this new direction for the club, and it just hasn't happened. So yeah, I think it's a great way of putting it, that this whole scenario has kind of hoodwinked everyone and yeah, made us think very differently about Ranić's time at United until the very end.
Transparency and the Glazers do not go together in harmony.
No.
Let's talk about the defence, because when Ranić came in, his first few press conferences, and it's worth remembering, his first few weeks were very weird, because he was appointed, from memory, and this is off the top of my head, he was appointed on December the 1st, just before we played Arsenal, but Carrick was taking charge of the Arsenal game. We beat Arsenal 3-2. Ranić's first game was December the 5th, I think, against Crystal Palace. Then we played Young Boys on the 8th, and then we played Norwich on the 11th, and then we were meant to play Brighton on the 18th, but there was a COVID outbreak at United, so that game was postponed. So it was a weird start to life, as it shouldn't have been, as we said earlier, because United could have appointed someone in that November international break instead. But Ranić came in, and in his first press conferences, he spoke very well. He impressed everyone, I think it's fair to say. And his first target was to kind of put the plug in the leak, because United's defence was terrible. We conceded 4 to Watford. We conceded 5 to Liverpool. We'd conceded 2 to City, but if they'd actually tried in the game, they could have scored 9.
Leicester.
Yep. The defence was a shambles. And even in games we'd won, like against Atalanta, we'd won 3-2. And there were a few games like that. Given how decent the defence was in 2020-21, what do you think, first of all, under Ollie, what do you think had changed to make it bad?
I think we had tried to become a team that played a lot higher up the pitch. And I think the Varane signing was all part of that. And on paper, I still wouldn't say that that was a bad decision necessarily. I think the process that we went through to come to that decision of being a team that plays higher up the pitch and signing a centre-back who is on paper, you know, a lot better at being a bit of a sweeper and can play alongside Maguire with more space in behind him in Varane made sense.
Yeah.
I think what that did, though, was a couple of things. One, it exposed our defenders a lot more. And as it turned out, Varane was often injured. Maguire took a big step back, had a bad season. Luke Shaw was often injured and wasn't at his best. Wan-Bissaka had a bad season. So I think the change of system plus the key part in that system not being there and all of our players being in bad form meant that we were now playing a system that, by its very nature, gives the opposition more space, which is okay in theory.
Yeah.
But then when you have players that are supposed to be defending that space in bad form and or injured, you create a lot of problems for yourself, because you're giving the opposition more space to play in, and you're having players with low confidence trying to deal with it. So I think that was probably the biggest change. And I think also in midfield as well, because we played higher up the pitch, it meant that Fred and McTominay in particular were, I think, a bit more limited in what they could do defensively. Because they're at their best defensively when we play in a low block, and they basically just have to make a nuisance of themselves. When they're trying to have to mark sort of space, that's not what their role should be.
Exactly, yeah. It exposed all the flaws in our players, basically. Because the first performance at Wolves definitely gave some reason to hope. It was that more attacking 4-3-3, and it had Varane in it, and he looked really good. But as you said, it exposed all the flaws. And that's really where Solskjaer's downfall was, in changing the identity of United and the style of the team and the shape of the team. He didn't have forget the man management, because that also plays a part, but he didn't have the ability to execute that properly. And it showed. As well as that, there was the poor individual form. So Shaw, Maguire and Rashford was injured for a bit, but Shaw, Maguire coming in after massive Euros disappointment with England. And I think it's underrated how much of an impact that had. If you look at that England team, apart from Declan Rice and Mason Mount, probably Rice and Mount carried on being very good. And if anything, got better. at the start of the season, but Saka had a really difficult start to the season. Shaw, Maguire, Kane had a bad start to the season. Calvin Phillips was injured for much of it, but when he played, wasn't as convincing. There were lots of players in that England team who suddenly looked bad. And I think it's and Sancho as well, I think was actually quite impacted by not only the kind of the devastating fact of how England lost, but also by the massive racist abuse that he and Rashford and Saka suffered afterwards. So there's that poor individual form, the failure to execute it by the coaching staff, and also, yeah, just the ability of the players just wasn't there. And that comes down to kind of recruitment, doesn't it? That United should have signed a midfielder last summer and we didn't.
Well, yeah, exactly. I think, to be honest, I don't mean to...
It's worth remembering how much of an impact that has.
Yeah, I don't mean to sort of trivialise and oversimplify a lot of United's problems, because they run a lot deeper than this, but I do think that failing to sign a midfielder last summer was probably the single biggest thing that went wrong, I think, this season, on the pitch purely. Because the other thing that comes with playing higher up the pitch, and this is where attack and defence, they go hand in hand so much. The other problem with playing higher up the pitch is that if you're losing the ball as often as United's midfield generally loses the ball, with the likes of Fred and McTominay in there, you're giving your opposition the same number of chances to attack you, but giving them twice the amount of space into which they can attack.
Yeah.
When you play higher up the pitch, you also necessarily need to be giving them less chances to counter-attack on you. And that means being better at keeping the ball. It means being better at building attacks that aren't counter-attacks, that are more sustained, where you keep the ball for 20, 30 passes and create space. That wasn't something that United were good at in 2020-21, and it's not something that we were good at in 21-22. You mentioned that Wolves game, Harry. So go on.
I was just going to say that one of the biggest complaints I think we had consistently in episodes early in the season before Ralph came in under Ole was just complete lack of tempo in how we pass the ball around. And that comes down to that, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you mentioned the Wolves game before, Harry, and you're right, there were signs that it could work. I remember Varane having a great game in that one at Molineux. But the other thing that happened in that game was, I also remember about seven or eight occasions in the first like 40 minutes or so when Adama Traore would absolutely just drive through our entire midfield and defence. And we were very lucky not to concede to him that day. But that, I think, was an early indication for me that because we weren't good enough at keeping the ball and creating space and creating good attacking opportunities when a team was sitting quite deep against us, it meant that as a result of playing this higher line, we were just giving the team the same number of chances to counterattack us as Adama Traore is, you know, one of the best in the world at doing, but giving them so much space that they could run into. So they do go hand in hand, and I think that was also part of it. If you're asking a centre-back like Harry Maguire, even Harry Maguire in good form, he is not the style of centre-back that is great at defending 50 yards of grass behind him.
Yeah.
You know, and we were basically just putting him in that position too many times. And that's not to say that Maguire is vindicated for this season. He's not. But
even Shaw isn't either.
No, exactly. It all goes together. And I just think the idea of playing higher up the pitch was good in theory, but I think it accentuated a lot of the faults that our players already had. And I think maybe that's where Solskjaer's sort of tactical side of things needed to be better.
Yeah, I guess the truth is it was good in theory, and it was a thing that we had to do at some point, and that was the right time, if not too late. But what we didn't have is the right recruitment and coaching to facilitate it properly. And that is a failure of Solskjaer and his coaching staff, but also massively of the board. Just to wrap up on defence, in the 2020-21 season, United conceded 26 goals from open play and 14 from set pieces. 14 from set pieces is outrageously high. This season, we conceded 49 from open play and just 5 from set pieces. So we did fix a set piece problem. 5 is one of the best records in the Premier League. And so I suppose that comes down to Eric Ramsey, who people have criticised because we still don't score from set pieces, which is a fair criticism. But we have stopped conceding from set pieces. On the other hand, from open, maybe it's because teams don't need to score from set pieces because we're so bad from open play. So we'll see about that next year. But yeah, it was a completely different defensive style from one season to the next. And actually, a very different attacking style too. And what was incredible about this last season is we had so many different attacking problems. It was an incredible variety of shitness across the entire year. So if we think back to the start of the season, there was some freedom, typical of an Ole Gunnar Solskjaer team, some freedom, but we couldn't control games. We had no tempo, no sustained pressure, and no obvious consistent patterns of play in our attack. There was very little identity to our attack. You didn't know how they were going to do. It was down to individual quality. And that showed in results. When we were winning games, apart from Leeds, because that's an anomaly, when we were winning games, it was by a goal, and often we just weren't scoring despite having a lot of possession. When Ranić came in, we eventually found a consistent style, and we found some identity, and we found an ability to sustain pressure really well and to create a lot of small chances, but we couldn't finish at all. And that's where things went wrong for Ralf Rangnick, because once those results didn't come, then the players stopped having any faith in his methods. And then we get to the end of the season, and there was a bit more of a balance between defence and attack that Rangnick was looking for, but the finishing still wasn't good enough and the confidence was low. And our defence collapsed. And so whatever we did in attack didn't really matter, because we didn't have the ball. And when we did have the ball, the confidence was so low and everything had fallen apart. And there's not really any point looking at it because the players had stopped bothering. So across the season, lots of different problems, which means unlike in the summer of last year, when we kind of knew what United needed to fix, it is now very unclear what United need to fix, because we're starting from basically a clean slate, or actually a very, very dirty slate, but one with nothing on it.
Yeah, it was kind of puzzling, I guess, at the start of the season, that we seem to be okay at creating chances, but yeah, there wasn't really much of a pattern to it. Like, even going back to the Leeds game, all of those goals seemed to come from very different moments, very different ways of creating chances. Then went and drew against Southampton, or against Wolves. We didn't create a whole lot in that game. If I remember rightly, I think it was a Greenwood like deflected shot that we scored from in that game. So it was just right from the beginning of the season, it didn't feel like we were particularly, what's the word? I guess succinct, or maybe is a good word. I don't know. I don't know what the word is. I'm trying to say we looked disjointed, basically. But what's the opposite of disjointed? Just joined up, I guess, maybe. Anyway, <Yeah. laughs> we looked quite disjointed in attack, and I think that carried on for much of the season. Obviously, dragged by Ronaldo. I know there was that whole story, or not story, but the whole sort of debate among the fan base of whether Ronaldo was kind of disrupting the way that we played. To be honest, I'm still unsure on that. I think it's difficult to say that Ronaldo made us worse at this point. As we said earlier, like, we gave him player of the season. He scored so many vital goals for us. Did he change the way that we played? Yeah, I think he probably did. And he may have made us...
Yeah, if you forget the debate about whether he made us worse and you just have the question of did he change how United played? Yes, definitely.
Yeah, and he may have made our style worse. Like, he may have made us more disjointed, but that doesn't necessarily mean he was a net... like a net negative for the team, if that makes sense. Like, I think it's still possible that he was a positive to this team, which I think he undoubtedly was this season, but made us more disjointed because he was less involved in the way that we wanted to build our attacks. But yeah, I think the point about, you know, everyone wanting to play on the left was also a real challenge that I don't think we ever really got hold of throughout the whole season. It's something that we've been trying to figure out for 5 or 6 years now, though we still don't have anyone to play on the right. Sancho was supposed to be brought in for that purpose and has spent the whole season playing on the left. So it's just, again, it's a failure of recruitment. It's a failure of planning. It's a failure to put all of...
Sorry to butt in. I found it funny how... So Alanga, obviously, very good season in overall. Yeah.
I think I know what
playing on the right. Yeah, I found it funny how Alanga, our right winger, who's done very well, and then this summer... he was playing for Sweden, scored his first goal for Sweden, which is great for him. And he's a brilliant character and he's an exciting player, but was like, yeah, I think I actually prefer playing on the left wing. So United have yet another winger.
Elanga took him out on loan next season now.
Prefers playing on the left.
After those comments.
Well, yeah, so Elanga, Rashford, Sancho, Martial, if we're including him.
Yeah, Greenwood at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
But obviously not now, yeah. All wanting to be on the left.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a curious thing. Again, it's a failure of all parts of the club. It's a failure of recruitment. But even if you don't get that recruitment right, as manager, especially Ollie, you still got to be better and be able to get more out of whoever you put on the right, or, you know, but somehow tailor it to make it work. It's a failure of all levels.
But then so Solskjaer at times tried putting Pogba on the right, and that was... So start of the season, Pogba played on the left and looked great.
Yeah.
And that was when Rashford was out injured and Sancho wasn't in the team yet. And he was so good there for the first few games. I think it was 7 assists in his first 4 games. And come the end of the season, he finished like 5th or 6th in the assist charts, because he'd had such a good start to the season, even if from October it was terrible. Or not terrible, but mainly rubbish. But not just, so it's not just Rashford and the wingers and Sancho, but also all the team's best creators, even Ronaldo and Bruno and Pogba and Shaw and Telles. And Telles is actually statistically one of our, when he plays, is one of the players who creates more chances than anyone else. All of them are left-sided players. And so that's why Pogba was often tried on the right, to try and balance things out. So it's not just the fact that the wingers don't play on the right or aren't as good on the right. It's also the fact, and yes, so it comes down to Wan-Bissaka and Dalot, yes, but also in midfield, even the midfielders and the attacking midfielders and our strikers all naturally float across the left-hand side and prefer to work in those areas. And that's just terrible team building.
Yeah, it is. It's a failure of planning ahead of how this team is actually going to look on the pitch. I literally just rewatched rewatched Moneyball last night, and there's that famous line in Moneyball where they say, you don't need to be buying players, you need to be buying wins. And it feels like United very much are, and have been, they've bought players because of how they think that individual, what their quality is, instead of actually thinking about how they contribute to the team winning. And I think, you know, we've ended up in so many situations where we've got too many players who bring the same thing to the table, or who want to operate in the same spaces and can't actually complement each other very well. And that what you were saying is the perfect encapsulation of that we had. What, how many players did you name there? 7 players potentially who could probably, 6 of them at any one time could easily all be on the pitch together, and all of them want to operate in pretty much the same part of the pitch.
Yeah. Yeah. And a couple of them are leaving now, which we'll come on to. Any other thing in terms of kind of our play in possession? McTominay had a bad season after having had a really good one.
He really did.
He didn't kick on in the way that he needed to. He showed his limitations on the ball. He showed his limitations off the ball. And because in the Europa League final, he was man of the match, even though we lost the game. That was a really good performance. And he'd had several great kind of big game displays. And he just hasn't kicked on this year, which is a shame.
It was odd to me, particularly how, like, the way in which he played badly this year, because one of the things I really noticed about him was he would sort of hide when we had the ball, especially when the centre-backs would have the ball. He'd have a habit of just kind of hiding behind whoever was putting pressure on the centre-backs and sort of asking for the ball, but knowing that it could never get to him. Whereas even Fred, who even before Christmas, when he wasn't playing amazingly, you see Fred, and he was so much better at creating an angle and making himself a viable passing option. And that's just really not like McTominay that we've seen before. Like you mentioned, he had really good big game pedigree. He's always come across as someone who will sort of stand up and take responsibility, even if he's not the best player. You know, his limitation has never before been that he won't take responsibility and try and take things on. It's more been that maybe he doesn't have the ability to pull it off. And so it was just odd to see him sort of revert to that way of playing when it's not really something that we've seen from him before this season.
Yeah. And he still has the right character. One of the things that will really stick with me from this year in terms of bad moments will be at Arsenal away after just such a disappointing defeat and another really bad one. And McTominay coming over and just kind of, he just looked utterly dejected and just kind of putting his head in his hands and properly, genuinely apologising for what we'd been watching, and that will stick with me. And I still really like him, but I think this season has shown, and maybe it's possible that he can kick on enough next year, but he's not young. And I think this year has probably shown that he's at best a bench option for United going forward. The only other thing we should probably mention is David De Gea, who had a great shot stopping season, but in terms of contributing to United in other regards, there was an interesting Athletic article which said De Gea had the lowest share of his team's passing attempts, which doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing, but I think we can agree in this case probably is, because he just limited the way that we built up chances so much and consistently all throughout the year.
Yeah, there was a great thing that I quote tweeted by John Harrison, who was writing for goalkeeper.com, where he had basically quantified the goals saved or conceded above expectation for all of the big six goalkeepers, but through what they were doing in different phases of the game. So there was like shot stopping, there was distribution with your feet, shot handling, 1v1 positions, sweeping up from through balls and then passing under pressure. And basically it was almost exactly what you would expect for De Gea. He was by far and away the best goalkeeper out of the top six with shot stopping, especially with general shot stopping. He wasn't quite so good at one-on-ones, but then his numbers were on the floor when it came to both general and passes under pressure. And all of the other goalkeepers in the top six, obviously, as you'd expect, especially Edison and Alisson, are adding so much value to their teams with the way that they can pass out from the back. And, you know, I think there's a pretty good chance that De Gea is captain of Manchester United next season. And to be honest, I don't think he should be starting, honestly. And I know this is something we've talked about before, but I truly believe that De Gea's lack of ability, maybe lack of, I don't even know if it is lack of ability, but the fact that he doesn't play out from the back in the way that a modern top goalkeeper does, I really do think it holds us back so much. And I think it's probably going to get worse under Ten Hag, because everything that I know about Ten Hag and the way his Ajax team's played, he wants a goalkeeper that can play out from the back, and De Gea is definitely not that.
Yeah.
And I do, it's an odd one because I don't think De Gea is, like, I if you asked me the five biggest problems on the pitch at Man United, I wouldn't put De Gea as one of those problems.
Well, there was an interesting line from Carl Anker, I think, in an Athletic piece that said United have for far too long ignored the nice problems until they become bad problems.
Yeah.
And De Gea is one of those. At the moment, he's a nice problem, but in 7 months' time, will he still be a nice problem to have, or will it be a bad one? Because his lack of ability, or as we've seen, lack of ability, maybe he'll pull something out under Ten Hag, but to play that role could hold Ten Hag back in terms of building his style at United.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a great way of putting it. The nice problems and the bad problems. And De Gea is a nice problem at the moment in that he's not terrible enough to be a huge detraction from the team. Like, he probably is still giving us some value because his shot stopping is so good. But I think we would be a much better team with, say, even if it was Edison, until you go to the other extreme of a goalkeeper who's not a great shot stopper but is amazing with his feet. I think United would be able to progress a lot with someone like that in goal.
Yeah. We were going to talk about the players who are departing, but we haven't got much time left. So Pogba, Cavani off, Matic off, potentially joining Roma. Not sure where Pogba's, not clear where he's going, not clear where Cavani's going.
I saw someone by the way the other day say that Matic is becoming what to Mourinho what Nico Kranjčar was to Harry Redknapp. I thought that was a great way of putting it.
Yeah, that's true. And then Lingard going, also not clear where he'll go, and Mata the same, also off, but not clear where he'll go. I think there's less so for Pogba and Matic. Pogba, the great thing is the feeling of what could have been. It's not true that he only had five good games for United. It is true that he wasn't good enough, and that the off the pitch stuff, and it's not even off the pitch with Pogba himself. I don't care if he's dancing or whatever. It was the off pitch stuff with his agent and his brother talking constantly shouldn't happen. And was too much. He provided he made my jaw drop on the pitch sometimes. The talent there is just unbelievable. And like the level of skill and technical ability is just outrageous. And I will really miss I'll miss like standing in Stretford End this season and Pogba just picking up the ball and just pinging it with just such like skill and nonchalance. He is obviously an amazingly talented player, but it was the right time to move on this. And I think for all parties, that'll be good. But he's our best chance creating player gone. So that's a big hole to fill. And then the others, the most emotional ones, probably Lingard and Mata. Lingard, things turned sour very quickly at the end, but he's a player who's been at United for 22 years since he was six and scored in an FA Cup final, a League Cup final, won several trophies with us, scored in an FA Youth Cup final and an FA Cup final, which is not something that many players have done. And yeah, played very well for us for a long time. So that is a sad one, especially the fact that he's ended in this way. He should have gone last summer with his head held high and with a great reception from United's fans.
Yeah, and I think he takes some blame for, I guess, the way things have transpired this season, but I don't think he takes any blame for the position that he's been put in. I think, you know, we were saying earlier, Solskjaer made some wrong decisions with players. I think probably undermined the trust that the players had in him, and this was definitely one of them. Lingard should have been gone last summer, and I think everyone could have walked away happy with what he'd contributed to United. But I mean, I think in general, the players that have been confirmed as leaving so far, they all make sense. I don't think there's anyone that would really be clamouring for any of them to stay. Obviously, I think Pogba is the one who you probably look back on with the most regret. Just it felt like there was so much that we could have done with Pogba in our team. And as I said before about United sort of buying players rather than buying wins, it felt like we just never surrounded Pogba with the right type of players that we really needed to get the best out of him. And that, you know, partly Pogba would probably take some blame for that, in that maybe he's not versatile enough. But if you put that much money into signing a player, why on earth would you not also put more effort and money into building a team around that he can be the star of? So, you know, I think we
thought we were signing a different player.
Yeah.
The Pogba we thought we were signing was kind of a number six. He literally wore the number six shirt. That's not who he was at Juventus, and that's not where he would have played best.
Yeah, but I think he's been at United long enough. Like, it didn't take us 5 years to realise that he wasn't a number six, you know?
Yeah,
And I think that was probably clear after 6 months or so. And at that point, there was still, you know, loads and loads of time to go out and build a team that he would really flourish in. And I don't think we ever really committed to doing that, which I think has been our downfall. Definitely. And obviously Pogba takes some blame for that too, because I also don't think that his approach to being at United has always been the right one. Not in terms of all the offers and stuff. Like you said, I don't care that he turned up with blue hair to Manchester Derby or anything like that. I do care that constantly there have been, you know, talks of him leaving. It's felt like he maybe isn't quite as committed to United as you might want. And he hasn't performed well enough on the whole. He has had some amazing performances. The one that always sticks out to me, not really a performance, but a moment, is that pass to Rashford when Spurs were playing at Wembley in Solskjaer's first sort of like honeymoon spell at United. That pass to Rashford for his goal was unbelievable. And there are going to be moments, I think, when we're going to see other midfielders try and do things that Pogba could do with ease, and you're just going to think, yeah, that's...
Yeah, the other one I remember, Anderlecht in Europa League. And it's worth remembering that him and Zlatan together were the two players that took us to those two trophies that year, really. Against Anderlecht, where I think he controlled it with pretty much every part of his body to take it over a player. Kind of knee, chest, head, shoulder, all of it. And yeah, that's when you think, bruh, what a talent. We should wrap up shortly on part one of this season review. Cavani goes after an amazing first season, cult hero status, and ruined in the second year for a whole variety of reasons, which we don't need to get into now. And Matic leaves with a very good reception after serving the club well for a few years and did very well at times, less well at other times. And in the end, it ended up being quite important in his last few weeks at the club, having looked like he was kind of being forgotten about for before that. We haven't quite got around to Loney's and Academy yet, so we'll shift that into part two. But we should wrap up after just over an hour of our season review. Thank you for listening. I hope to see you back for part two, where we'll be talking about what's coming ahead under Erik ten Hag and some good Loney's and some good Academy talent fit nicely into that conversation. See you then. Goodbye.
Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.